Back in the studio with us, we have the one, the only, the incomparable Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter, the truly last journalist in Troy, New York.
Not true, but thank you. I appreciate the kind words, and it's good to be back. Last week, one of the more interesting stories that I covered in last week's Troy Letter was a oral arguments in the David Bryce CDTA case. I'll recap just how we got to this point and just give a little bit of a primer because it's a little bit complicated, but I promise that it's really interesting. CDTA and David Bryce, who owns the Uncle Sam garage, that big parking garage that you see when you drive in from Green Island and past Dinosaur Barbecue on your left, that big garage that's sort of right at the entrance to downtown. CDTA has been in negotiations with David Bryce, the owner of that building, for a number of years because CDTA wants to build a transit hub or a bus station, you could call it, that would consolidate a bus stop that's currently on the west side of the garage and a bus stop that's currently on 4th Street on the other side of the garage into one mega bus hub that would be a sort of central hub where their eventual bus rapid transit line from Waterford and Coes down through Troy into Albany would pass through. And they would all, the bus station, which would not be, it would be adjacent to the garage, not actually in the garage, but sort of along the southern end of the garage. It would have like indoor climate controlled space and they would sell tickets there and they would have like real time information about when the buses are coming. So a real kind of bus station was the idea. And also one of the more interesting things about it too is that it would have bus only lanes kind of around the garage for easy kind of for buses to go this way and that way and whatever. And it was going to cost, it's going to cost, if it's ever built, millions of dollars, like big sort of capital investment. And CDTA had initially just tried to get a long-term lease at this property, just for the land that they needed, not for the whole garage. But they tried to negotiate for a number of years and they couldn't come to a final agreement. And so finally CDTA said, you know what, fine, we're going to use eminent domain. In other words, forcing David Bryce to sell a portion of this property, not the whole garage, but just a portion, strips of land kind of around it. So that they can build this project that's been, you know, now delayed for a number of years. And when a government agency tries to take property, it needs to kind of there's an opportunity for the property owner to challenge it in court. And so that's what David Bryce has done. He's brought a proceeding that isn't handled in the state Supreme Court locally, but actually handled at the third department, which is the appellate division that covers Rensselaer County, as well as like many, many other counties kind of beyond the capital region as well. It covers a pretty wide swath of area. They've sort of been briefing and filing, you know, trading briefs kind of in that case. And last week was the oral arguments, which is sort of like the grand finale of the case, where attorneys for each side come before a panel of the appellate justices. I think there were six of them in attendance or so. And each attorney gets about 10 minutes to make their case before the justices. Not their whole case. Again, that'll be filed in text form. But just if the attorneys want to emphasize any particular facet of the case. And also the justices have the opportunity to interrupt the attorneys and ask them questions about the relative strengths or weaknesses or gaps, you know, in their case. One of the interesting things that has been mentioned in the pre-argument filings, but just that was emphasized by David Bryce's attorney, is that as the eminent domain process was progressing, there's a thing called a public hearing in the case where just like it sounds, the public has the opportunity to come and make points about, raise points or questions or whatever about what CDTA is proposing to do. Again, take a piece of this developer's property and use it for a bus station. And the attorney for David Bryce emphasized that only one member of CDTA's board actually attended this public hearing. And, you know, he made, they did eventually, before they voted on the matter, the board, like, meet, and they were briefed on what happened there. So the board members ostensibly were up to speed on, like, what happened at that public hearing. But he sort of was like, you know, what does it say? Here's something where the stakes are pretty high. You know, the government's going to force this guy to sell his property. And the board members couldn't even be bothered to all attend the meeting. And the, you know, the justices seemed, you know, to, from what I was watching via video stream, seemed kind of, you know, sort of intrigued at least by that argument. I don't know if it will sway the case one way or the other. And, you know, the CDTA's attorney kind of countered that it's not necessary for there to be a quorum at these public hearings. As long, because there was no action taken, it was just they were hearing. It was just an opportunity for the public to be heard. Nonetheless, I don't think that it's not a great look for CDTA at the least. But you know, obviously, that's not the only question before the court to be able to decide. And then the other thing that just kind of, that sort of came up briefly is that, and this is kind of common in these sort of land use cases. David Bryce's attorney sort of made the argument that the environmental review of the project was insufficient, and that the CDTA sort of skimmed over that sort of stuff. And, you know, and by contrast, the CDTA attorney sort of countered that the board has the latitude to be able to do as in-depth of an environmental review as is there, you know, as is necessary or as they see fit. So that was that.
Right. Where was that meeting held again?
That's in Albany at the Third Department. It's a long, cumbersome name, but it's like the appellate division for state Supreme Court in this general area.
Gotcha. Okay. But you were able to find it on a live stream.
You can watch it online, which is great, which is sort of rare for courts. Like, mm-hmm. You don't often, in video at that, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States, I don't know if you can listen even live or what all the rules are, but you know, you can eventually see transcripts and stuff. But I know that at least like locally, when I would go to city court or something, like sometimes TV stations will be there for a particular case and ask if they can record, but usually the judge will only let them record video and not audio. But this is video and audio, and it's live. And accordingly, you know, the justice has sort of warned the attorneys before the arguments start that, like, hey, you know, if there's anything sensitive in your case, like a name of a child or something, like don't use their name because this is being live streamed and it's just going right out. So there's a lot of sort of precaution that needs to be taken by attorneys, and if there's like some sensitive or, you know, not completely public stuff, and you know, in your cases.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting quote at the end from a CDTA spokesman who was saying that the whole river corridor, the rapid transit line, is supposed to be apparently starting at the end of 2020.
Yeah.
How could that possibly be in effect? Are they just thinking that some of the buses will be running? Do you know?
Well, they have worked on bus stations kind of as in an ad hoc kind of way. It's kind of like the 80 and the 85 both kind of come through this area down along, one along river, one sort of parallel to river, down into downtown Troy. So some of the stations are sort of pre-built. You'll see if you drive down river, like some bump out, some fairly new looking bus stations. You know, they're not glamorous or anything, but just like noticeably new sidewalks in certain parts where there are bus stations. So they've been kind of pre-building stations in preparation to launch the whole line. So a lot of the work is done, but yeah, there's the big question, I guess, is this kind of centerpiece station where you can buy tickets. And again, it's kind of like this hub. You know, if they can't proceed, if they lose this case, you know, will they just keep the two stations on each side of the street? Will that screw up plans more dramatically? I don't know the answer. I don't know if they're probably waiting to, you know, to see what happens.
It seemed like this copy of Troy Letter focused a lot on different lawsuits and such. what were some of the other big suits people were paying attention to?
So last week there was a law committee meeting, which is the city council's, the committee of the city council that focuses on legal matters, you know, before the city. And it was mostly, the meeting was mostly held in secret in what's called executive session, which is just when cities are, usually cities have to, and governments have to abide by what's called, in the state of New York, what's called open meetings law, which basically just says that meetings that, especially meetings of where there could be, you know, fateful decisions made, generally have to be open to the public. You can go, you can record them. You know, you can watch them. Usually there's opportunity for public comment. But there are exceptions, you know, when governmental bodies need to discuss litigation, for example, and, you know, if they were to talk publicly about, say, strategy in one of those lawsuits, you know, that might be, that might put the city at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. So there's an argument to be made that those discussions should be kept secret. And so that's what, happened, last week. But before they went into executive session, the city's corporation counsel, James Caruso, that's their, you know, their top lawyer, basically, described it like in broad strokes what cases they were going to be talking about. Again, none of these cases were unknown previous to this. I had reported on some of them,
right.
But it was, he called them the big cases. In other words, the cases that are, you know, most likely to, or most threatening, or, you know, most potential for a big award to be given, you know, to be a big judgment against the city to be had in one of these cases if they were to go to trial.
Or late last year about the about forming the budget of how much they predict to have to spend on legal fees, and it was hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars when you include either judgments or settlement money plus outside counsel. I was going to talk about that after this, but I can talk about that now. So the city's corporation counsel's office, their legal office, is really just one full-time attorney, the corporation counsel himself, and then a couple or two or three deputy corporation counsels who are part-time, who handle, you know, one handles, like, you know, traffic court stuff, and, you know, one handles, you know, other general litigation. But they don't, you know, when a big lawsuit, some of these cases that I'm about to list, they need to bring in outside help, either because it's a sort of special area of law or a complicated area of law, or they're just more comfortable not having someone who's part-time handle the case. They want someone, you know, they want to just hire a separate firm to handle this. You know, they feel more comfortable. Or in one case, the city's insurance carrier said, no, you have to hire X law firm to handle this case because the stakes are so high, or because those are our terms, or, you know, whatever. I'll read a couple of the cases. So one case is the case of Jacqueline Myers, who sued the city in state court to recover for injuries she sustained when, in June 2014, she fell more than 20 feet through a skylight on a roof at the vacant and abandoned Leonard Hospital. Mm-hmm. Leonard Hospital is, you know, again, long abandoned. In the city council within the last year or two authorized bonding to the tune of, I think, up to $2.5 million to demolish this property. But because, you know, one of the reasons why is not only is an eyesore and it probably drags down, you know, the value of neighboring properties, but also it's like this attractive nuisance, you might say.
A great place to hurt yourself.
Yeah. And indeed, the very next case, the case of Victoria Lee Brothers, sued the city in state court again after she fell about 20 feet from an exterior catwalk at Leonard Hospital 2 years later than the Myers case in July 2016. So both of those cases are still pending personal injury, you know, lawsuits, basically, where they haven't been resolved. They've been going on. Both of those cases have been going on for at least a year, if not longer. It looks like, you know, one or both may go to trial. Who knows what could happen with there. So I don't know what they talked about specifically, but those two cases are big. Then there's the case of Cynthia Thevenin, who's the widow of Edson Thevenin, who after an African-American man who, after fleeing a traffic stop in his car, was shot and killed by Troy police in April 2016. Thevenin's widow sued the city in federal court, alleging, you know, basically civil rights violations of her husband. That case is pending. The case of Damique McDonald, who was not killed, but he was shot by a Troy police officer in 2017 during when the officer was attempting to apprehend him, I guess. And McDonald sued the city in federal court, again, alleging violations of civil rights. And then finally, and this is the most recent lawsuit, the case of two city residents who have disabilities who get around the city in electric wheelchairs. They sued the city in federal court over its alleged failure to maintain accessible sidewalks, curb cuts, and pedestrian crossing or pedestrian crossings and roads. So all told, you know, let's say that all of those cases went badly for the city. And when I say went badly for the city, I just mean that if the city were found liable in a court of law, you know, you could be looking at, I won't guess, but, you know, substantial judgments. So I don't know what they discussed, but, you know, the city council was, I guess, recently briefed on all that.
And was the Thevenin suit the one that they were required by the insurance company to take outside counsel?
That was, yes. Yeah. They're using an outside law firm. I can't remember the name of them, but yeah, that's who they're using. They're using an outside law firm to represent them. In that case, it looks like in the D'Amique McDonald case, however, the city is using one of their deputy corporation counsels to handle that case. And then finally, if we have time.
We sure do.
The city is currently looking to adopt a law. This is sort of an administrative item, although it is there's a little bit of interest just because it's a bit odd. The city is going to amend its city code. It looks like to allow people who have property owners who owe back taxes to enter into installment plans that allows them to pay their back taxes over a period of 2 years, kind of like a deal that you can work out to prevent your house from being foreclosed on. This is something that has long been city practice. So this under the old city charter, which was revised more recently, and that's why this is being discussed now. And it's also state law is authorizes it. But when the city revised its charter a couple years ago, it forgot or it was overlooked. They forgot to pass a new local law to kind of match with that. So this thing was off the books for a couple of years. However, no one realized it. And so the city kept entering into these installment agreements anyway, even though there wasn't a provision for it in the city charter. At the end of last year, one of the deputy corporation counsels who handles like property matters discovered this omission and said, oh, you know, shoot, we need to pass a new local law so that this is allowed again. But it seems in his opinion, it doesn't mean that those other ones are void, you know, that he said they were basically entered into good faith. It comports with state law because City Council President Carmela Mantella was at least kind of inquiring as to whether it's legal for when the city passes this law to basically grandfather in all of those previous agreements. So when the law is passed, it's going to have a retroactive component. And she even directed the Corporation Council to ask the Attorney General's office for an opinion on whether it's legal to retroactively allow those agreements. I don't know that the city's heard back yet from the Corporation Council's office, but from the Attorney General's office rather, but it seems like the city attorneys think that the city has grounds to be able to do this. So.
And so they'd be, you know, retroactively making their mistake legal, essentially. But what otherwise would be the consequence? Would the installment plans no longer be considered valid if this correction isn't made? Would it trigger like an automatic default, or is it just unclear?
I have no idea. I don't know that they went the public meeting that I went to last week. No one, you know, went way down the rabbit hole saying like, oh, what if we can't, you know, retroact? I don't know what that would mean. I would assume that would mean some major headaches for people in the assessor's office and the corporation counsel's office. But I don't know. And for what it's worth, I should mention, too, that the someone from the comptroller's office at the city said that that any of all the property owners who have entered into these agreements since summer of 2016, none of them have defaulted. So it seems like it works. Like,
well,
it seems like
hear.
That when people enter into these agreements, they're able to not lose their home, which seems like a noble goal, all things considered.
Right. Yeah, I guess in that light, we should be willing to say no harm, no foul. Yeah.
I think that that's probably where the Attorney General's office will land too, although I'm guessing.
And you also had a good quote from Mayor Patrick Madden.
Yeah, so the Stewart's down the street is has closed. It's a block away. Just on a personal note, sometimes in the summer when I would ride my bike up to these appearances, I would often stop at that Stewart's and get like a seltzer or something before I went on, and now I won't be able to do that. So I guess I won't even – why should I even bother coming here anymore if I can't even enjoy that amenity. No, but on a serious note, you know, it's never nice to see a store like that that serves a purpose and, you know, close like that. And indeed, that's sort of what the mayor said, because I asked him, you know, would he encourage Stewart's to maybe rethink that decision? Stewart's basically had said that the store is too small, it's not viable. They've been expanding their kind of prepared food offerings at a lot of their stores. Like the one on Hoosick, they completely redid.
Right.
The one on 4th Street in South Troy also had some sort of expansion. You know, they used to offer gas, I'm told, at that one right here, but they took the pumps out a while ago. Oh, and I think overall it's kind of too small of a lot for them to make it work, I guess, or for it to, you know, fit into their business plan going forward. So the mayor said it's too bad, but he stopped short of saying, like, I demand, you know, that's not really his style. He's not he's not quite Bernie Sanders in terms of, like, you know, like the way Bernie has kind of gotten on Amazon, you know, about stuff.
Right,
you know,
there's
no, that's not really the Mayor Madden style.
Well, we really thank you for coming on the show, giving us all of these updates and this excellent news. Where can the listeners go to stay up to date on Troy news?
tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or just email me. I'm luke.s.nathan@gmail.com. Say I want Troy Letter and I can sign you up.